You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This episode of the Comedian's Comedian podcast is proud to be brought to you in conjunction with Mike Birbiglia's new show at the Leicester Square Theatre, The New One. I saw this show at the Montreal Comedy Festival last year and I genuinely think it's his best. I'm an enormous fan of Mike. I'm hoping to get him on the podcast soon. If you're not familiar with him, you might know him as the star of Sleepwalk With Me, which was a film that he wrote and directed himself and performed in, which was based on a brilliant stand-up show of his. His more recent shows were called Thank God for Jokes. You might know him from the Lonely Island movie Pop Star Never Stop Stopping. You might know him from Orange is the New Black or Girls. He is just absolutely fantastic, and he's coming to London this June with his show, The New One. The first show has already sold out. Tickets are selling fast for the 9th of June at Leicester Square Theatre, and you can pick up those tickets from rabbitrabbitcomedy.com. I cannot stress to you how much I love Mike Birbiglia. The last couple of, I have had near misses with booking him recently over the last couple of years. And I'm really hoping to nab him this time. But whether I manage to or not, do not miss out. Go to rabbitrabbitcomedy.com and get your tickets to see him on the 9th of June at Leicester Square Theatre. The show is called The New One. And once you've seen it, we can have a very exciting chat about it in the Facebook group.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and this is the Comedian's Comedian, the only podcast about comedy. So today I'm going to be speaking to Maria Bamford. As many of you will know, I have been trying to get hold of Maria for an interview for some years now. I very nearly snagged her at the Montreal Comedy Festival. We nearly managed to meet up at the LA Podfest. And now I am able, finally, to bring you this conversation with her, which was recorded at a hotel in London who made me pay for the privilege of using their meeting room for an hour. So out of sheer snark, I'm going to give thanks once again to Angel Comedy, who let me use their brilliant podcasting space for the Andy Nyman and Jeremy Dyson episodes that came out last week. So thanks to Angel Comedy and boo to you, anonymous London hotel. Now, if you're not familiar with Maria Bamford, what can we say about her? You might know her Netflix special, Lady Dynamite, which was one of the most innovative ways to take the life of a comedian and do... I mean, there's the classic, this is Seinfeld, he's a comedian, we don't see him doing comedy, but this is a sitcom about his life, and that has been much mimicked. But Lady Dynamite is a completely fresh and original take on it. I first discovered her material, I think I first heard people at the Edinburgh Festival years ago telling me that I was an idiot to have missed her, and her stuff is on Spotify, you can buy it from her website, you can buy it wherever you buy your comedy. It is just an absolute joy to see someone so flexible. As I say to her and she squeals with delight, she is just everything I want from a comedian. Her rhythm is impeccable. Her writing and her writing choices are superb. Her choice of subject and her meshing together of subject matter with kind of a framing, the way that she... I could go on about her all day, but there's no point. I don't need to, because this is me actually speaking to her. If you haven't heard any of her stuff before, then I highly recommend you press pause now and listen to or watch Old Baby on Netflix, her most recent stand-up special, which is, again, as uniquely filmed as all of her stuff. The special, 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 which is her doing an hour-long set to her parents in her own living room. I mean, you get the picture. She's incredibly innovative, incredibly imaginative. And we will get into some pretty big chat as well. I should warn you now about mental health. She is bipolar type 2 and has spent some time in an institution, and we talk about that. But also, I would simply say that it's a wide-ranging conversation that takes in a variety of topics related to mental health. So if you are concerned that you may become upset by discussion of those topics, then please proceed with caution. That said, I am so pleased to at long last bring you this conversation with the absolutely wonderful Maria Bamford. Tell me about London. Tell me about Edinburgh. This is your I read that this is your London debut, these shows at the Leicester Square Theatre. And that you were last in Edinburgh something like 12 years ago.
12 years, yeah.
What was your experience of that?
Well, I did it Brian Hennigan probably like 15 is good. Came for just 2 weeks, and that was super fun because I was just doing feature sets.
Okay.
And so it was hilarious fun. I stayed in Brian Hannigan's apartment in Scotland, who now he lives in Los Angeles. Then I came for the month, and I also probably was not doing super well. I needed to be on a different set of medications. I found out mood stabilizers, and it was rough. It's just the schedule of shows is just so intense, and then the reviews are so beautifully written.
and that's something Americans aren't used to.
Well, yeah, they didn't used to review shows at all. Now they have started doing
that. I'm sorry, I feel like that's our fault.
No. Well, it was so delightful in that it was like, we're listed along next to strip shows and karaoke in the U.S.
Okay.
Like, it wasn't considered an art form. And then, so I think the hard thing is when it's beautifully written and it's a bad review, you're like, oh, God, they're right. Like,
yeah.
And it wasn't, I didn't get a bad review, but
as we talk about bad reviews, a bin lorry has driven up outside, reversed by beeping, and is now about to make a series of banging noises, which is perfectly apt.
Fair point. I mean, I think what I'm about to say is could be thrown in the trash. I think one reviewer said I was apolitical or could have gotten more deeply into my political beliefs because it was too unclear of what I was trying to say in my act. And I was like, oh, right. Oh, yes. You are totally right about that. So it actually was helpful because I was like, oh, maybe criticism is actually very helpful, you know,
really?
To the process.
I try and ignore all of them.
Well, I think I'd like to use it. Because if somebody's gone to think about my stuff for a while, I appreciate that. And I read reviews of other things, like of films and stuff like that, and enjoy reading reviews. So why not use it if I don't agree with it or I think, oh, yeah, that's true, and I don't care, you know?
Yeah. Like, okay. That's a more mature attitude, I think, than mine.
Yeah.
I think I'm sticking my fingers in my ears.
Yeah, because I had a couple of people on Facebook contact me who were fans and said, oh, I saw your show in Eugene, Oregon, and you just seemed kind of spacey and like the show was, and I felt really disappointed. And I was like, oh, ew, people. And then I was like, okay, listen to the set and see if what they said is right, you know, or has any merit to it. Because it's like it was two different people. And usually I don't get, I mean, not that I'm the greatest, but I think my the people who like my stuff are also on the side of, it's so great that you're alive.
Yeah, totally.
We know that you're fragile, which I don't see myself as fragile, but sometimes that word is used to describe me, and I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm tough as nails. I think it's because I tremor. Uncontrollably, but that's the brand, weakness.
We'll get on to that. That's my first kind of peg sort of starting point. We'll certainly get to that.
But, so I went back and I listened to the set and I was like, oh my God, they were completely spot on. Like, not that I did a terrible job, but I was kind of riding off the goodwill of the audience and not putting on a show. You know, you've got to put on a show, not mumble. I mean, right now I'm very good at stuttering and mumbling. It's quite a gift. I received it from my father, and I'm bringing it on into the next generation, but I won't have children because I'm barren. That means I need to, and even as I grow older, it may mean that I need to rehearse more. I may need to tighten it up. I mean, especially if I'm doing new material, just pace it up, speed it up, so that at least to create the perception that I'm not stumbling. And so I really actually appreciated the criticism. I sent them their money back, and because I was like, yeah, that blows. I don't know if, yeah, no, so I appreciated it. Now, of course, if that's the business model I'm operating, you know, I'm grateful that the 800 people who were there didn't ask for their money back because, we already spent it on the dogs. I do value that someone cares enough to say something. If it is criticism like, that blows, or please don't talk about that, or one lady said I did too much grunting in my act, and I was like, well, that's clearly on you.
There is some grunting, but you know, there's like too much is a very that is a parameter that is yet to be decided, and she doesn't get to decide the level of the grunting.
What if I mean that's what I'm going for,
yeah,
so.
Right. Talk to me then about this. That's one of the for me, I thought of the show I saw a couple of nights ago in Leicester Square Theatre, and I saw you in Montreal last year and recognised some elements of it. We might talk about the differences and how the set has developed, how the psych ward stuff has kind of developed and been edited and stuff. But that was in the show I saw two nights ago, that first moment of weakness is the brand it was the first punchline that had a cheer accompanied. It was almost like a kind of, I don't know what, it was like a chess move. Do you know what I mean? Like, joke, this is funny, we all get it, bang, this is Maria. So talk to me about that, because it seems that it has such a delicious kind of perversity to it, whereby it is, weakness is the brand. I don't know what the question is, but talk to me about weakness being the brand.
Well, and I think that's true of, I mean, I think that's true of a lot of artists, you know, where it's like you don't go out to see someone live so that you, I mean, I guess you do go out to see something stupendous like Cirque du Soleil. You go, oh, I hope nobody dies. But you don't go, God, that's amazing. I could never do that. But if it's a personality, you want to see them, you know. So I think, you know, that isn't... you want to see the human part of them on some level. Of course, that's the direct opposite of what I just said of tighten it up, Bamford. I think that is because as I get older and I do become less, more vulnerable physically, I'm probably not as fast, not as, certainly not physically as, I don't wear the cloak of youth. I've got to be honest with what I have and, you know, hopefully, or I've always found, or maybe I've just read it so many times in O Magazine, Oprah's magazine, that, you know, it is... It's your weakness that that people are. What's your worst fear, or your what you think your greatest weakness is actually your greatest gift. You know, like that the thing that I think is going to disgust everybody the most, make it impossible for me to work is actually has turned out to be a huge cash cow.
Well, it's interesting that you sort of couch that in reference to Oprah's magazine, because presumably that has been a part of your act and a part of your understanding of your act
for longer.
Long time. Yes,
yeah, I mean,
yes.
That means it's that's more meaningful to you than a kind of magazine soundbite.
Yeah. Like, all artists are trying to, you know, make sense of the world that you're living in, or try to keep living in it in a way that feels meaningful. And I definitely find, hopefully I'll listen to podcasts from your podcast account, because I didn't know about it, because I don't know what's going on in the world. But about how to continue creating things when there is a sense of nihilism. Like in the United States right now, it's just so brutal. You know, it's just like, oh, wow, it really doesn't matter. I don't know, maybe it does. I keep calling my congressmen and senators. I keep marching whenever there's a march. I wish someone would stand up, and maybe it should be me or comedians. I always feel like people don't take comedic premises seriously as genuine possible policy. Because I've heard so much great. This is when American comedian who suggested sending a marching band, a high school marching band, into any foreign conflict. And I was like, because they're so positive. And I was like, that's not a bad idea. I think it might be less expensive. I think it's hilarious. I don't think it's, you know, I just think some of these premises could be, things like, instead of Guantanamo Bay, this is a joke from a long time ago, but, you know, to put people to work, as radio DJs or something that might be genuinely irritating to them, like that they wouldn't want to choose. I'm sorry, I've lost track.
That's quite all right. You mentioned the nihilism with reference to the kind of politics in American life. But I think one of the reasons that you are not just enjoyed by your audience, but championed and loved by your audience, is your kind of visible conflict with nihilism.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So when you say weakness is the brand, I think what we're cheering, why I laughed, I think, was because it was a sort of like you're kind of reappropriating your weakness and turning it into a strength. And the fact that it is spoken through the language of entertainment and kind of the grubbier bits of it, was like, yes, it is great. You get that. Yeah. And you own it. So I wonder the extent to which your visible weakness, or our perception of your weakness reflects how you feel about yourself. Whether you feel, do you feel vulnerable or weak on stage, or do you feel powerful on stage?
I think it's just a mix of it. I mean, it depends. I know that it is a very, I am completely dependent on the context of the audience already being on board. I'm completely,
that's a beautiful
unbelievably
way of putting that.
Grateful that they are there. I have no, I can't remember that word, fantasies or whatever, that, oh, it's because I rock the house. No. It is because the right people were there at the right time, you know, because I can bomb anywhere at any time very hard, despite my swagger and my confidence. And people will be confused for a little while because they're like, she seems so confident about being terrible.
These sentences are so densely written. Why aren't they making me laugh?
And then there will be some talk or people asking me to get off stage, either amongst themselves in a passive way or directly. I think that's what comedy, or at least for me, has changed a lot. I don't know if it's as a result of fame or if it's a result of the internet and people being able to find things that are specific. You know, people going, oh, the YouTube things before they go now, or I do. You know, I go, oh, am I going to enjoy this? Let me take a look at that, you know, before I spend $30 going to see something. Because it used to be more of a trap. You'd go to comedy and it would be like, oh, no, like, or whatever it is, you know, any kind of music or dance or something. And now you can research and avoid, which can be a good thing and can be a bad, you know, because you have less surprises, I guess, of discovering something.
I think when people come to see you, one of the, and it's that thing about you being our champion.
Yeah.
And I said the same thing to Jackie Cation. I interviewed Jackie a couple of years ago, and she is like a different type of champion
than
you're very similar energy, and a very, like a parallel kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that when we come to see you, we are, you know, we're watching you triumph. I have only seen you in environments where everyone was loving you.
Right.
So I am trying to imagine, I suppose, looking
go
at
go to a pub later on tonight.
Yeah, right. I'm watching Old Baby, Netflix special. That you've got this fascinating device of performing the material initially to yourself in the mirror and then to a small number of people, sort of increasing numbers of people in odd situations. So I can imagine, like, seeing you do that, that must have been so weird to do the material to yourself in the mirror.
Oh, no, that's how I rehearsed it.
Is that really?
Yes,
okay.
Yeah. So that's actually a very comfortable place for me to be. Like, I feel very joyful and creative actually doing it just to myself. It feels very safe. I did that a lot as a kid. I would perform things to myself in a mirror. So, or one or two people, anything theatrical, I'm totally down with it. And that was a super safe experience. Like, I find it I just want to say the premise behind that, doing the special that way was context, was mm-hmm. how, like, people will, I have a dear friend who the first time I met her, and she asked what I did, it was a comedian, she tells a story, so this is how she tells the story. I met Maria, and I was like, you say you're a comedian. Oh, man, all right, well, good luck. I mean, she seemed nice, but it's kind of old to be a comedian. And then I saw her in an open mic, and she was okay. And I thought, well, you know, good for her. And then I saw her at a book show, and there were people who liked her, and I was like, wow, that she's getting good. And then I saw her on a TV show, and you've got something. It's like the same jokes. The exact same joke. You just go, it's so stupid.
It's almost reflective of that thing of when an audience feels comfortable. It's one of those things about low ceilings in comedy clubs.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, we can all hear ourselves laughing. Yeah, yeah. I'm giving myself permission to laugh.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting, by the end of Old Baby, when you are performing in a much more usual Netflix special context.
Yeah.
I mean, what I mean is a theatre show context for some reason. It's not like Netflix has got the copyright for that. But it's sort of almost jarring because we've now got such an intimate relationship with you.
Yeah.
We really get a sense of that. I'm like, oh, why are you sharing this with everyone?
We thought it was a secret. Yeah. Oh, no.
But I think it's clearly becoming less of a secret. If you look at, I remember hearing about you. I was at Edinburgh the year that you were there most recently. Yeah, yeah. I've been to a few of them recently. And I remember hearing, it was one of those kind of buzz things where comics are going, oh, have you seen Mary Bamford? You know, there was that sort of experience. Nice. You're clearly in a very different place in your career now to where you were then. Like, it's kind of been, I don't know, things can be meteoric over 10, 15 or 20 years. I mean, it's certainly, there has been a phenomenal upward kind of incline.
Well, and I think that's like the because of the internet, you know, all that stuff, I think there's just so much more. And I've heard it about comics here. They say there's just so much more work and so much, like, there's less of that. There's self-empowerment. I mean, I heard about the Bill Murray Theater where mm-hmm. a bunch of comics bought their own space, like, and you can make your own show and become your own show without asking anybody to do it. And that is, which gives me hope about the future, whether or not I, you know, continue to get work. You know, I can create my own work, which is very hopeful and exciting. I feel so lucky. It's been a very surprising late in life boon.
So this is Maria. You can hear it's another one like the Patton Oswalt one. It's just one where you can hear the glee in my voice. She is one of my very favourite comics, and I just cannot get enough of her stuff. She just takes comedy to another level. And in saying that, I realise she won't be everybody's cup of tea, but please find out and please spend some time. Now, that sounds disingenuous, doesn't it? I don't mean it to. I tell you what I'm referring to. You know, the Acaster specials came out on Netflix, all four of them, Repertoire, and I really recommend you get stuck into those. Someone on the Facebook group said, lots of people going, whoa, it's Acaster Day and celebrating. Someone on the Facebook group said something a bit disparaging about them, which is not really how we operate in the Comedians Comedian Facebook group, and as a result, a lot of people, it wasn't quite a pile-on, but a lot of people did various fun versions of Come On Mate, Read the Room. And lo and behold, the next day or a couple of days later, this gentleman apologised and wrote a really lovely post saying, look, I watched the specials, I watched the first one in the wrong environment, I was with a bunch of mates, we were only half concentrating on it, and we all got sort of bantery about, you know, not enjoying it. And actually, he said, he went on to say he really values the community, the kindred spirits of the ComCom community in the Facebook group. And so he really regretted it and he deleted the post. And there's been like 150 likes of that post. Everyone has just jumped on and gone, thank you for apologising on the internet. So that is the spirit in which I say, look, not all comedy is for everyone, but please, you owe it to yourself if you're any kind of comedy fan to check out Maria Bamford's work. Now, enough of that, because I know a lot of you will be listening to this from the point of view of already being a deep, committed and lifelong fan. A joy to talk to her. We will go back into that conversation in just a second. If you'll allow me a tiny plug for my own stand-up comedy tour, which, I mean, I know I mention it frequently, but the reason I do that is people get in touch with me to say, hey, are you coming to my town? When I've literally just been in Nottingham 2 weeks ago. So if you would like to come and see the show, I will big up the next few places that are coming up on the tour. We have got on the 27th of April, Reading South Street Arts Centre, Corsham Pound Arts Centre on the 28th of April. On the 4th of May, if you happen to be in a particular town in Wales, you can see me there. And I'm doing a huge room and it's half full, so that is really exciting. I've already sold more tickets than I ever have there before, but we really bit off more than we could chew on the size of the room, so fill your boots. I'm also going to be doing a redacted at that Mystery Welsh Festival, so get along to that. I'm hatching a plot for that, and I think it's going to be a particularly special redacted, even by our very special standards. The 11th of May, the Hen and Chickens in Bristol at the Comedy Box, fantastic. The 12th of May, the Rondo Theatre in Bath. 16th, Epic Studios in Norwich. 18th, the Royal and Derngate in Northampton. And the 19th, I'm going to be at Warwick Arts Centre, which, as we all know, is actually in Coventry. Henry Tudor House on the 20th at Shrewsbury. Swindon Arts Centre on the 23rd. Farnham Maltings on the 26th. And on the 30th of May, I will be at the Westie, the West End Centre in Aldershot, which is always one of my very favourite places to return to. They really care about their comedy and they really nurture and cultivate an excellent comedy audience. So that is up until the end of May. And then there's a bunch more dates in June as well. I'll go into them another time. Thank you to those of you who have been donating recently. I normally like to read out the names of anyone that's become a subscription donor, but last night I finally got round to one of my reply to all the emails saying thank you, Jags, and spent 2 hours on a train doing that. So I'm afraid none of those are at my fingertips. What I will do, however, is read to you a lovely email from someone who donated to the show, wanting, as he did, to support the podcast with something a bit financial, just £1, £2, £5 or £10 a month if you're an absolute hardcore beast. But this is an email from Gareth, who I thanked him for his donation, and he replied saying, your podcast is a central part of my car journeys to Wexford in the south of Ireland where I live to teach guitar. You and Adam Buxton normally going toe-to-toe in podcast championships. I fancy Adam would catch you with some dirty punches, but my money's on you for stamina and technique. Plus, you could make him cry with some carefully crafted questions regarding his desperate need for validation. Formulaic but effective. And then there's a little emoji of a winky face. I think that's beautifully written. Who would win in a podcast off between me and Buxton? My money's on Dr. Buckles. He's a heavyweight, right? Plus these dirty punches. I don't know where I'm hearing about these from, but I love the idea. I love the idea that anyone would think I had stamina in any capacity at all. So thank you very much to Gareth for that lovely email, for your donation, and indeed to all of those of you who are getting on board the Let's Financially Support the Podcast train. And as I mentioned before, we are edging ever closer to a big revelation about something pretty exciting that is going to be purely for recurring subscription payment people. I'm trying to make it work for everyone. Patreon basically makes it easy to give people extra stuff, but I am trying to not tie this to one system. It's incredibly difficult and time-consuming, but I'm kind of enjoying it in the way that I am always a frustrated tiny empire builder. More news on that soon, but there has quite literally never been a better time to sign up for a subscription payment at comedianscomedian.com/donate. Now, let's get back to the wonderful, the miraculous, the uniquely talented Maria Bamford.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So, in terms of how you created something, like the conversation I was having with my friends after your show the other night was that you are such a complete, you're such a comprehensive package of a comedian, because you have like the incredible voice element. We'll get onto that. You've got stories nested within premises, like you never just describe a thing. It's always built into a brilliantly kind of fanciful premise. You know, when you're talking about your experience on the psych ward, seeing that through the eyes of a set dresser.
Yeah, you know, there's always
like an additional level, something else to enjoy, something to enjoy at the same time. Or you're talking about, you know, Christianity and your atheism and your mother's religiousness through the concept of, you know, trying to score points off each other in a competition. I was watching Old Baby on the way here on the train, and that element of your doing the Sudoku of your kind of joint, you know, you and your husband's joint. Do you see the point I'm making? Everything is nested within everything else. And then you've got these incredible sort of sentences where the punchline is simply a way of describing something. That's one of the most exciting things to hear as a comic, where, you know what I mean, the punchline isn't, not always, but it isn't A to B, and therefore, you know, a reversal of the idea. Actually, there are things which are simply huge punchlines just from the perfect turn of phrase.
So I think my question is,
how do you do all that?
What do you do now?
What have you learned in the last 10 years? What's different about how you write now?
I think it's always the same. And that, I think, is the most humbling part of it, in that I really love talking to new comedians, like, just because I, on some level, have lost that drive, you know, of, like, creation of, like, going... Yeah, this is an awful thing to say, but I learned that money, property, and prestige don't solve anything the easy way. I learned it the easy way, and so I'm But to just like, how are they creating new things? And so for me, it's always been the same way, where it's start from scratch and go, I'm so excited, this is the greatest idea ever. Oh no, it's shit. And then, you know, kind of going back and forth, and then just going, well, this is what I have. And then just keep doing it, and developing it, even if it seems like it's not going anywhere. And and I would say, it's, if anything, for me, sometimes it's gotten harder as I get older, because there isn't that carrot at the end of this where I go, once I do a half hour, an hour, that's when I'm going to feel great and I'm going to know I was a great comedian. And it's like, nope. Then right after you do an hour or whatever, somebody goes, so what's your next? So you doing anything? I mean, especially like our society has just sped up. Like we've just sped up more. Like I've comedians here, like 200 dates a year or 550. It's like, it's just, there's just more, you know? So just calm down, Maria, and just work on what you have in front of you. And, lately I've been, obsessed with, I mean, I always am kind of obsessed with morality and religion and things like that. And so, I love the idea of sports and that it is kind of a religious experience for people. I mean, I think it is. It's not just it is, brings people to tears and rage and connection. And I don't have that experience with those things at all. So I would like to. So I think bringing those things together in a way where I can beat my mom and at Christianity is compelling to me. Yeah.
Is that something that you can, with that bit, do you realize that after, now that that bit exists?
Yeah.
Or was that an attempt to combine the two? Did that idea come in? Well, I'm fascinated by the idea of sport. I'm fascinated by the idea of religion and the similarities between them. Maybe I'll try writing a bit where those two things come together. Way around did it happen?
Well, I think how that came about is as a kid, I loved those stories. I loved the Good Samaritan. I was like, right on, yes.
Yeah.
So I was like, Mom, there's this guy. He's covered in newspapers. His name's Francis. Let's have him over. And my mom was like, oh, honey, no. And just the feeling of like, the disconnection. And not saying my mom's a bad person, and maybe she was right. I mean, the guy would highlight things and swear at odd intervals. So maybe she was right to not have him over the house. I don't know. But just that conflict within myself, especially now I am not an underdog anymore. The business of made as a result of doing this special for Netflix and season and TV show, I grossed about $1.6 million last year, which is the most I've ever made in my entire life. But and it's the business, not myself. I think I took in about $500,000 or whatever I paid myself. But you know, so I am no longer the destitute, I have a pool. And so what am I doing? You know, what am I doing? Am I, because I think that's something to me as a comedian has been a place of safety of going, well, I'm struggling, so I'm not totally responsible for what's going on in the world.
Yes, yes.
And now it's like, wow, yeah, you're making a choice, and I don't want to say, but yeah, I should be giving more than my fair share back. So I do joke about that my husband and I aren't giving 11%, which we are giving 11%, but often I think, oh man, we should be giving, as far as what I've said about wealth or whatever during my act in the past, like I just go, I should be given like half away. You know, like I generally, and they've done a million studies that you don't need any of this stuff and or don't need more than $80,000 a year and to be happy. So anyways, and my husband and I have talked about that. We're not sure what we're gonna do about it, but we'd like to follow through on that. My dream with this sitcom that I did for Netflix, I kind of wanted it to be like a nonprofit sitcom.
Oh God, that'd be so great.
Oh, I desperately want it. I already have so little willingness in terms of dealing with other people. Like I didn't have the energy, it's hard to say whether it's laziness. probably laziness that I could not get it together to get people together. But I am working on a new project where this developer, we are going to put it in from the beginning that all of merch sales, we were working on an animated series for kids, all merch and hopefully a percentage of the profits made by that will go to children's advocacy program. So anyways, we'll see. Hopefully that will happen. But it seems like those things are so, it seems so hard to stand up for yourself. Like I didn't realize, and that's part of the reason I do stand up, is because I can say exactly what I want and I don't have to discuss it with 12 people and get their feedback. And TV shows, on my own television show, I made did not speak up a lot in ways that I regret, of course, now. I think it turned out great. A few things I definitely apologize for. There was some things about a bisexual meth addict, which turned out to be very just sort of a cardboard cutout thing. And actually, I've dated two people who were bisexual who had methamphetamine problems. So it wasn't from a lack of experience with it, but I just should have made it a more nuanced character than... there were just a few things that I could have addressed better, I think, in the show that I didn't do. And partially wanting to go, oh, I want everyone to have a good time. Like I wanted everybody on the writing staff, like, yeah, you get your ideas in too. Like, but then part of it out of pure sloth, you know, of just like, listen, you guys do it. I'm going to go out and just stand up and say, you know, because I don't know how to write scripts or don't have the desire to learn how to write scripts. And I was executive producer on the show, which can mean so many things. Sure. But for me, it meant I went in, ate a salad and said, you guys want to hear some stories about what I think about things? No? Okay, I'll be back. You know? So,
Did that element of it make you feel vulnerable? Handing over what in their eyes, or some of their eyes, certainly the producer's eyes, is the brand, but to you is your life and your very carefully kind of moderated and honed version of as much as you want to share.
Yeah.
You're handing that over into someone else's.
And I think earlier in life, maybe, but I feel like I've gotten out my perspective so many times, you know, whether it's in stand-up or I did a web series, you know, the Bram Bamford Show, and I feel like I really got out my perspective and what, so the things that were important to me, which also didn't fully come across to me in the show, like I wish, and I just didn't fight for it. One thing that really bums me out is like when they try to make it as if stuff's going on during any kind of hospital. I mean, I'm sure people have their own pet peeves of like, I've had that experience and it was not at all like that. And I know there's, because it's comedy, they had to have an opportunity for story or have people in there with me doing things and characters in the, but I just think it was so much more hilarious. For me, it would have been more hilarious if it had been actually what it was, which is nothing happening. Just absolutely no one's communicating. There was one person who was manic, who was, Turner was a comedian I knew, and he was booking gigs on a telephone, which was hilarious. He had just assaulted someone with a knife so was in the psych ward, I think, to get away from a possible jailing, but was booking gigs up in Washington State, which was, as a memory, so delightful. And I was so jealous of him. I was like, God, I wish I was bipolar one, you know, with bipolar, because I think he was in a psychotic state, which is, that's a terrible thing to think, but it was what I thought at the time. Anyways, but the truth is you can't do anything at all. Like I didn't, do anything or connect with anybody or have, you know, we weren't making stuff. I mean, nothing like a vision board or, it was, yeah, it's just, that bothers me. Like, I just go, I'd rather have it more completely realistic. But at the same time, maybe it was that way. It was part of storytelling. So, I don't know. I don't know how writing stories works in a visual sense on screen. So, but that was interesting to me to kind of let go of, or maybe a part of aging and just going, and greed, you know, going, oh, I would just like to get paid, and you do whatever you want with this. And there were some things my sister bowed out, like she didn't want to be portrayed during the show, which I think was a good idea on her part because the character ended up being very mean-spirited towards me, so much so it was like, yeah, it wasn't very much like my actual sister because my actual, you know, anyways, but I've already portrayed my sister on stage and, you know, who cares? Who cares? There's a billion television shows like it. Who cares? So that's kind of, it wasn't very precious to me at that point I did get anxious. Like other things about inclusion writers, which is now very new. Like I wanted to have the staff be, you know, half women, people of color, that, you know, and that didn't happen. There were some women, I think 4 out of 12, and the head writer was a woman, Pam Brady. She's a delight. I mean, everybody was on. It was amazing. Writers, great. But I think I definitely could have said, hey, let's go out of our way because there's plenty of people. There's plenty of people. And I think in that sense, getting different perspectives only makes things better, you know, or more interesting. Like I just, more vulnerable and so I think that, those are things I feel like I regret about, but maybe can work towards doing that in this next thing. I mean, that's the thing. You always find a new thing you're working on and go, oh, this, I'm going to do this differently this time. So.
And is that the second series of Lady Dynamite?
Oh, no. That's done. Okay. Lady Dynamite is canceled.
Okay.
Are you just finding out?
I'm just finding out.
Oh, I'm so sorry. No, it's okay.
I thought I had read earlier that there was a second series.
Oh, there's a second season, but there's 2 seasons, but it's done. Okay. It's done. Which I, so I'm sorry. Oh, it makes me less attractive as a podcast. I'm
no,
so sorry.
Oh, my God.
I'm so sorry. But it is true. Like, immediately, if something is canceled, like I had a comic come up to me and just like, yeah, I heard it was canceled. Well. I mean, I guess you can still keep doing stand up. You know, it's weird how your prestige dips so quickly.
Well, I don't know. There's prestige and there's prestige, isn't there? There's other people who are jealous saying things like that because of their problems. And then I suppose there's also your take on the situation. Like, I can't imagine anyone that I've ever had on the show saying something like, oh, no, there isn't a second thing. Does that make me less of an interesting guest? Yes, you know, that, I know you're joking, but the idea that would even occur to you.
No, but I think it just in the human aspect of it, it does. Like, we're all animals, and you look to the strongest, fastest animal who's doing, you know, seems to be doing the best. And
we want Jennifer Aniston to show us where the bananas are.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, you just, it totally makes sense. And also, like, as a part of a vision, I hope, I've gotten more than enough success, you know, more than the average bear. And frankly, it is time for other people, other experiences, whatever, to have a voice, you know. So, if I can create jobs, you know, that's what I'm hoping with the animation series, to create jobs for people, like, I mean, including myself, of course. Obviously, there's a selfish element to it. How embarrassing. But that hope is to go, okay, other people have a chance to work, because it's I'm tired of my own voice. Yeah.
When we talk about other voices in the animation series, and I know your animation CV is, your resume is enormous. You've been in everything.
Yeah.
What's the relationship between the voices and the writing process? It sort of puts me in mind of you as a girl or as a comic looking at yourself in the mirror, building material through the voices, or building, is that part of it? Or do the voices come as a sort of an expression of when the idea is finished and you need to...
I think they're a defensive mechanism. I mean, they're like very much my own voice it's been told to me is not always attractive, or, you know, you sound like a baby or something. So it's kind of like a trick, that's a very negative interpretation.
Yeah, I mean,
of it.
Kind of it.
Right, I'm so sorry. But that the fun part of it for me is, or the part that is joyful for me, is to feel like lost in a character, to feel like, you know, and to feel like I really, because all of it, I mean, when you do act out a character, it's obviously it's me, you know, it's not there's no person out there. It's like, no, I've said that, you know, like I've either said that to myself or felt that about myself, or I mean, some things my parents have actually said, but the way I'm saying them probably isn't the way they meant it. Or if they could, you know, if they had a chance to speak for themselves, they'd go, oh, I, you know, didn't mean it that way, you know, I don't know. But and I only do about six, I would say, voices.
Well, I'm just thinking now, there's one of my favorites is the kind of Hispanic or Latino kind of, I think of her as a sort of, not quite a nurse or like a nail technician. There's some sort of, I can't, maybe I'm using the wrong, I don't know many Hispanic or Latino people.
Yeah,
I don't know, are those okay to say those terms? Which, do you know the one?
I call the hotline, mental health hotline, and I don't do that joke anymore, partially because I didn't want to co-opt, because there has been so much issue with that, and I want to be respectful to people. Like to go, oh yeah, me doing an impersonation of somebody, you know, and it was something that actually happened. Like a woman, she said, it was like, it was a mental health hotline for my insurance, and the woman was so hilarious because she was like, you know, you should go see, you know, some comedy, and you know, you're, you know, that's, you know, that's crazy, some of the stuff you're thinking about. And it was really, it actually, you know, it was helpful, you know, in how funny it was. But yeah, I don't do that one because
I mean, I hadn't thought of that at all until, yeah, that's a good point.
It's a real, and you know, I think that's for good, because it's one thing if the equal amount of people were given a microphone to express themselves in our society, in the United States. But that is not the case. It is still primarily white men on TV. Mm-hmm. So until that's different, Marie, why don't you shut the fuck up? You know, like, there's other things. It isn't, I don't know. I just think, unless it's, I can think of something else to talk about, or, or come from my, because I feel like, I do this sexual fantasies about social issues, and the genre of intractable social issues. And at first, I was like, I could use different dialects or different. And I was like, no, jackass, talk about it from the limited sad,
limit of knowledge that you have about these issues. Like, that's enough. You don't have to pretend that you know what's going on, that, you know, I'm clearly not woke in any way. I don't, you know, please feel free to wake me up whenever I'm saying something completely tone deaf. Because not to be afraid of not saying things, but to be respectful and to be kind. You know, I think that can definitely be a part of comedy, like that whole thing of I can't even think of an example of this, but just in terms of, as a woman, if somebody guy's doing a joke about rape or I'm trying to think of something that I feel vulnerable about. Oh, this is a perfect one. Sometimes I've had it where after I've gone up, comedian has said, wow, she's crazy. All those voices, but she's a psycho or, you know. And you just go, you know, okay, funny to somebody, but was kind of a punch down, unless that guy's going to say, yeah, I have mental health issues too. He's basically kind of, you know. So I just think, I don't know, I think there is not... I don't want to talk about censorship, but also I think there can be kindness. I think there's just a difference between that. Like my husband and I was in that same book, Social Issues. Mm-hmm. So he does a thing where we go to give a massage, and he was like, hey, you kind of make me sound kind of cardboard cutout, sort of like a two-dimensional character. And I'm like, oh, yes, you are right. Oh my God, you know. And so we rewrote it together, which turned out is funnier and also more accurate. And I don't know. You know, I'm sure there's a huge gray area that I'm not getting at, but.
I think when you do the kind of the higher status voices, when you do your mother or your sister attacking you previous albums, those impressions I think are so good. I sort of understand the risk that you feel, that you've expressed, that you're kind of taking, because they are such lacerating impressions. Like, right. You're so gifted at that kind of caricature. You know, the way you'll see someone, like a brilliant mime or a street clown, might do an impersonation of someone walking past, and just in their walk, you see that person's hypocrisy is exposed.
You do the
same thing with the voices, you know.
Yeah.
Like in every twang and intonation and breath, you hear the sort of the hypocrisy of your sister or whatever, you know.
Well, that's, I do, and part of it is, it's part of myself. Like, I had this one joke we do about a comedian who came up to me who was perfectly nice. But I had just gotten out of the psych ward and I was just very wobbly trying to do stand up again. People had known what happened. I had to cancel like 6 shows in Chicago quite suddenly because the night of I couldn't speak. I was like going, it was really, it was extremely frightening to me. And anyways, had to cancel all these shows. And the guy, I'm sure he was trying to relate with me. I mean, we're all just trying to relate with each other. And he was like, yeah, wow, I heard about what happened in Chicago. Man, I've never done that. I've never bailed on a show. you know, I had a temperature of 495 degrees. I was a temperature of a fully charred pork chop. And I still, you know, I did my 90 minutes and then I, you know, because... you gotta give them what, you know, and then I lost control of my bowels, but no, you gotta, I test myself, you know, comedy's, you know, it's gotta be funny, you know, and it's gotta be funny to everybody. If it's not funny, it is not comedy. I test my shit out. I go to China every year, and you know, I do, I do not have a visa, and you know, now I've got like a type five. I've got a bunch of chopstick impersonations, and you know, just like that braggadocio or braggadocio. Sorry. And machismo of like, which I love as a comedian. Like, I can fucking kill. I just destroyed. You know, I can go up against any crowd. You know, and I love that about comedy. Like, I love to embrace that. Go like, yeah, I just did a show, totally bomb. Who cares? Fuck that. Or, you know, like, yeah, I just did three shows on a Saturday night. And, you know, sold about $1,000 worth of merch. You know, I love that part of comedy. But at the time, you know, I was just like, yeah, man, well, because I didn't want to go up and do the show because I couldn't think or talk. And I just thought that wouldn't be as funny as I'd hoped. And, you know, I totally relate. You know, some people are, can do shows on while having major psychiatric breakdowns. I haven't. I also didn't want to. Part of it was fear. I didn't want to break down on stage. Part of it was also responsibility going, I don't want to have a horrifying show for people. You know, and some people love that kind of show. Charlie Sheen was touring during, yeah. You know, all right. And maybe it was a great show. And maybe, I mean, I can understand he wanted to do those shows. So fantastic. And I don't know, I wasn't at those shows. So I don't know how they went. But anyway, so all of that is just me angrily trying to respond to someone rather than saying in the moment, hey, why don't you shut up? I love to just act out things, you know, whatever, years later. I should have just told him, hey, man, I get it. You had had the flu, you know. And I felt so ashamed of that I ended up canceling the shows. Like, I felt ashamed that I didn't see it coming. Like, I remember the week before those shows, I wasn't able to, like, I was just slowly, like, losing it. And I kept trying to run my material with other comics going, do you think I'm okay? Like, I kept saying to people, hey, do you think do I seem okay to you? And they're like, yeah, you seem fine. Yeah, oh, you're going to be fine. Because, you know, everybody thinks you look fine. Or you, as long as you're standing upright, it's like, yeah, you can do a show.
Yeah.
And
yeah, we've all talked each other out.
Yeah,
You know, talked each other up. Like, yeah, you'll be fine, you'll be fine. Yeah. I think that the kind of the catastrophic breakdown you're talking about is so far out with anyone's experience or ability to judge.
Or you have to be there. It has to be you, like, in that moment, which, you know, is it bad enough that I have to cancel all these shows? Like, I was bleeding. I cut myself on something. I'd lost all my identification. I was walking around Chicago. I was weeping, and I was just like, I called my mom. I'm just like, what do I do? And she's like, honey, just go to the airport, you know, go on Delta Priority, tell them your gold medallion, get out of there. Yeah. Which is hilarious because she didn't say, I'm coming to help you.
Yeah.
She didn't.
You come to me.
Yeah, she's like, says, which I love about my mom. She's like, listen, oh no, I've got my book group tonight, so I can't make, I've already got plans. But she was lovely. She came out to the psych ward and read Oprah magazine with me, page by page, and needle pointed a pillow, and she was perfectly lovely. And my mom, she's had a psychiatric breakdown. She had a steroid. She was given a steroid, and yeah, she had a psychotic break, and so I had to go in the hospital. So, you know, she's been through that, and yeah, and I think that's one thing I totally value about the comedy community is everyone's just like, oh, right on. You know, like nothing's a big deal. My manager, Bruce Smith, I love you, Bruce. He, when I called him, you know, to say from the hospital, say I can't, you know, he was like, all right, yeah, okay. Yeah, I got two other bipolar clients. All right, well, just call me when you want to get out, you know, when you feel like you want to work again. You know, which also, I mean, I know the reality of business. You know, if I stopped bringing in money for over 2 years, maybe he'd have to rethink our contract. But there is a sense of understanding and thoughtfulness, which that I appreciate. But you know, again, it's also money. I mean, I think from my own point of view, I've had people who have had mental illness episodes, who other comedians who have died of the illness, and it is such an irritating thing to deal with when someone is not well. So I have all the empathy, sympathy in the world for someone who, you know, if somebody's acting out or having some episode, you don't have to work with them. You know, you can go, hey, you're not doing well. You need to get help. And a professional comedy venue is not the place to get help. You might need to. So, and we love you, and we'll come visit and bring you chocolate, because they don't let you have chocolate in there usually.
Do you feel safe now from the danger of that happening again?
Well, I mean, I think if you stay on meds, if you, you know, I'm not a real drinker partier. I'm also a little older, so, and I've stayed on meds consistently. So at least the studies and things that I read, they say if you stay on the meds consistently, there's less chance of an episode. I also have less, I think my bipolar is it's type 2 so far, knock on acrylic, and bipolar 1 can be much more severe with rapid cycling, and you know, so people can have much different experiences. Also, as you age, it can I've heard poop out, like where it gets less as you get older. Maybe it's when you're older, at over 50, when you're that's what I just heard from my psychiatrist, because I'm moving in on 50. So I have high hopes, is what I'm trying to say. But you know, if it happened again, the wonderful thing is that I've told everybody.
Yeah, right.
So it's no big deal. Everyone's like, all right, you know.
Yeah.
Which I love that about. I mean, I really appreciate that. Anybody who's been open about anything in life, you know, bankruptcy, losing a child, you know, anything where it's like you share something devastating that everyone's afraid of happening. It's like, okay, so it's happened to you, and you're still here, and you're still managing to, you know, laugh. And that's what I think the arts are for, is just to be able to remind each other that we're not alone. Or to make a lot of money.
We must wrap up, yeah, but yes, I'm just interested in the relationship between your bipolar and your day-to-day happiness, and the extent to which you can kind of, when you're not suffering from an episode.
Yeah.
What's the relationship with your day-to-day happiness and then consequently with your work? And
well, what is so miraculous is that for the past 7 years since I got on this medication regimen, which is Depakote, I'm on 750 milligrams of Depakote, which is a mood stabilizer, antipsychotic Seroquel, 25 milligrams, and then 40 milligrams of Prozac. For whatever reason, I have not had any suicidal ideation, really, or any episodes of, I mean, for my entire life since the age of 10 onward, I had probably daily weeping. Those would stay up all night, you know, having to vacuum and getting so much great writing done. Oh my God. So, and having tons of energy, but also having tons of energy to kind of do self-destructive things. One night stands with strangers, you know, all the things that go along with being depressed, like wanting to kill myself, planning to kill myself all the time. I think it was all ideation up until I was about 40. And then I was like, oh no, this is, I'm done, you know, like, you know, so, so it really is not an issue for me anymore on some level. I guess the one thing that is, there's some ongoing things where I have some anxieties about, that I have always had, wanting to be good at something, you know, wanting to be, liked and stuff like that. But I don't think any more than an average bear. Like I seem to be have the experience that other people have of like, oh, we just had fun the other night. Like I never used to understand what people were talking about when they're like, oh, it's just, oh, it was just fun. I'd be like, what do you mean by that? Like, was it like a set of excruciating circumstances that I haven't had before? Like I just, I mean, it not, there are some highs, but I had a lot, it was mostly depression and then agitated depression. Agitated. Yeah. So and I think that did help me with comedy. I thought could get very obsessed about, doing 5 shows a night, you know, I could be isolated. OCD really helped me because I didn't want to be with people at all. So I would spend a lot of time rehearsing and just going to shows, and not speaking to anyone. And so now I definitely have a more full life. Whether that makes me a worse comedian, oh well.
that's a great answer. Would you have swapped it? I think that's a terrible question. Would you? You know, I mean, it's such a part of. It sounds like it's such a part of not only the things that you talk about, the means by which you're able to talk about them.
Yeah.
And if you are happy with your life as a comic and your output as a comic, and
I think I could trade it because that's a, you know, 20 years is a 25, gosh, 25, 30, 30 years to go with thinking about suicide all the time. I think I would have been, I've been good without that. I think that would have been fine. Yeah. I just think, that's not necessary for a good life. Because, I mean, whatever, fame or the feeling that you're good at your job is so fleeting. And I think feeling good over, you know, having good memories is everything, you know, like you're having a good life where you can enjoy things and have friendships and relationships, which I did not have a lot of in terms of, didn't feel like I had hanging out, like where people go and do things. I just didn't enjoy doing that. And now I'm doing that. And it's like, ah, what a delight. Went out to a Chinese restaurant with a bunch of comedians last night. So fun. And, I think I'd trade it in a heartbeat. Because who knows? I'd have wonderful stories of a bland, happy times.
amazing. Thank you.
So that was Maria. What a joy. What an unalloyed joy to talk to her, to watch her perform. Oh, and I should say as well, when I saw her show at Leicester Square Theatre, her opening act was Felicity Ward, friend of the show. She will have been on this show maybe 100 episodes ago, something like that. The numbers escape me for now. But she has always been brilliant. And holy hell, watching her do a 20-minute opening set before her hero. And Felicity made no bones about the fact that she is as much of a Maria Bamford fan as any of us, myself included. It was such a joy to watch Felicity just destroy, arguably walking similar territory to Maria, but with a completely different rhythm, a completely different approach and energy. She was the perfect choice to support Maria Bamford, and she just took the roof off. And it's so lovely to see someone whose work you know and love just tearing the roof off. And you can see people. I was sat at the back of the room and I could see people being converted. You know, when you watch an audience, they're laughing. And then as soon as Felicity left, the audience were all turning to each other like, who was that? We've got to find her stuff. So I just wanted to make a little honourable mention for Felicity for being such an excellent stand-up in that capacity in particular. That's everything. Thank you very much to Angel Comedy for letting Mandarin give me the recording space for this one. Thanks, Angel Comedy. You're a bunch of great guys. Thanks to Nathan Wood. Thank you to Matt Hoss for some of his logging duties recently. He's currently working on a podcast with Tez Ilias, which is going to be coming to you, if not next week, then pretty soon. Thank you to Bruce Smith, Maria's agent, with whom I've been having some really hilarious correspondence over the last 3 years as we try to make this happen. Thanks to Maria for coming along, her family for letting her come and spend an hour of their holiday time together talking to me. And thank you to Georgie Donnelly and Felicity Ward for their part in helping to make this happen. That's it for now. I will have a little post-amble with you in just a moment. Do not miss Mike Birbiglia at the Leicester Square Theatre. I'll stick around for a post-amble if you will. But if not, that concludes the podcast. So something that I've really been doing in the last week, my wife has been rather poorly. And as a result, I have ditched a load of work that I was planning to do, and which is one of the great things about being freelance. You just go, no, let's let all of these projects just rack up and fill my email inbox for another week. There are so few things about freelance lifestyle that there's a lot of very positive things, of course, but the freedom is a big one. And I suppose now that I'm a parent, there is less and less freedom. So I relish it in a different way. But this week with my co-partner, my life partner being poorly, I've been doing loads of solo parenting and it's been so much fun. I mean, I feel terrible that she's been sort of sick in bed and me and the boy have been trying to minister to her. And he is, hey, do you know what? I don't often talk about parenting in the post-amble, so maybe I'll just let myself do that for a bit now. You can probably turn off if this makes your blood boil. But God, he's hilarious. He's so funny now. He's so talkative. We were listening to... So he just strings... He's only sort of two and a bit, and he strings these great long sentences together. We were in the car, and we put some music on the radio, just sort of something random. He's got very specific tastes, but sometimes we just put the radio on to save us from either Lady Gaga or The Lion King or whatever else he's into. But I put the radio on and it was a female vocalist and some pumping electronic music. And he said, it's not Lady Gaga. It's a different type of Lady Gaga. Oh, my God. He's only two. Like, I didn't even know he knew the word type. But there's something so joyful and startling about a child's language as it develops and grows and you start to recognise, oh, he's comparing a thing to another thing. He's recognising that these things are a subset of those things or whatever it is. It's absolutely joyful. But taking the reins, as it were, for myself, not that he wears reins. Who puts kids in reins? That's one of those things, like, he's never had a dummy. And I don't understand why people need dummies. I will probably get the whole of Mumsnet descending on me now explaining that actually some people do need dummies. I'm sure they do. But I thought babies had dummies. And we never gave him a dummy. And now he's never had a dummy. And I've every so often you see a kid with reins. Are those particularly hyperactive nutcase kids that run off at the drop of a hat? Is that what it is? Maybe it's that. But anyway, the point is, all parenting styles are acceptable. Not all of them, but, you know, don't be judging. Don't be, what is it John Hegley says? Before you complain about the muck on someone else's glasses, check the muck on your own glasses. I've minced that. I've butchered it, I'm sure. But the point is, it's been a really interesting and fun time because now, and anyone who's seen my last two shows will know that one of the things I was struggling with is the sort of one-to-one time with the boy before he was a boy, when he was just a baby. And now he's got opinions on stuff and it is a whole new world of
possibilities of conversation, of talking him through things, of asking him things. It's a whole new world. And I suppose in my kind of in the pre-toddler period, where the child is just a sort of a little cocoon thing that you have to change and look after and prevent from crying and cope with crying and all of those things. A little cocoon thing, how beautifully put, you know, with a human mind. That period was quite long. And now that we're out of that and into the next bit, it's just, I'm experiencing this real flourishing. And it's just so much fun. So much fun to hear his opinions on stuff. I don't like, he says about things I don't like. He's got this weird accent. It's partly Minnesotan, I'm sure of it. I think me and his mum, we were really into Fargo, the TV series. And as a result, we would speak to each other in cod Minnesotan accents during the first months of his life. And I really think something's rubbed off, because I think, I mean, could he be Minnesotan? Is that how genetics work? Who knows? This is the worst post-amble ever. This is just me going, oh, my kid's amazing. But look, I haven't made you go through many of these recently. I suppose with this being the Maria Bamford episode, there should be a post-amble that is more directly related to mental health or self-care, or not simply because there's some of the challenges that Maria's had to go through, but also the basis of some of her material has been that. I don't think I'm reducing her to just someone who has had mental health issues. But we've done a lot of that recently. And the more, this is nice. You know, people, you know, you sometimes email me. You know when you email me. Sometimes you email me from the perspective of like, oh, I'm 3 years behind on the podcast, so I'm just starting to hear about XYZ. And I get a real sense of, like, I might get an email from you saying, I hope everything works out with your kid. And then I might the next email I might look at, also from you, might say something like, oh, I'm really pleased that you, I've just got to the bit where you finished your journey with your therapist. And it's just amazing to have the last 5 years of my life story reflected back at me in such a kaleidoscopic manner. It's really exciting. I mean, I suppose it's just the same as looking through an old photo album, except it happens on a more random and exciting basis with other people's input and other people's description. It's like looking at a photo album of photos of you that you haven't seen before. How exciting is that when someone, you're around someone's house or someone shows you a thing on Facebook or whatever, where you see a photo of you and you don't remember it being taken. And it's clearly you, but it's a time in your life that you only really remember and visualise through photos that you yourself either took or, you know, photos that you've known for years. And the way when you have a photo of something, then that photo kind of replaces a lot of the, it crystallises a lot of the more swimmy memories and you go, oh yeah, I remember that. And actually, a lot of the time what you're remembering is seeing that photo. So when you see another photo of yourself that someone else took and that you've never seen before, you're like, oh my God, I remember I used to wear those. Wham! That happens quite a lot when you email me in a sort of microcosmic way based on this podcast. And I think all I'm trying to say is, I'm still pretty chipper. I'm pretty happy. And it's really satisfying. And I think part of it has been with the increased workload with the boy of the last 2 years, and specifically this week. I just haven't had time to wallow. I haven't had time. It's actually been really good for me. I think, of course, of course having a child's been good for me. But what I mean is not simply the presence of the little guy, but also the vast mountain of other shit I've got to be doing and the fact that I don't really ever look out of the window anymore. I'm only assuming there's still a sky. Because I used to spend a lot of time reflecting on stuff and listening to songs that made me feel all bittersweet and going, oh, I remember this memory or other. Bloody well, I haven't got time for that now. I feel like I've compressed all of the air out of my life. There's no wandering. There's no wondering. I have to deliberately make an effort to wonder about stuff. I write in the car now. Did I mention that? Not physically. But that's the only time I get to look out the window, and I'm looking straight forward the entire time. But I'm finding that time very valuable in a kind of a churning away, cogitating. Do you remember Mike Gunn talking about writing and then going for a run or going for a walk and then letting the kind of the back brain churn through the ideas and then sitting down for the second half of that writing session? Well, I feel like I've been doing that, but without having to do the exercise. Oh, dear. This is not a long-term plan for the future. Gotta get healthy doing something. This, even by the standards of a rambling postamble, is awful. Is it? Bits of that were good. If only it were possible to edit this down to the best minute. You wouldn't want to hear that. You don't listen to it anyway. But thanks for emailing me, you. And please continue to do so. I'm going to get on with the next 150 things in the Tiny Empire. Thanks for listening. I enjoyed this episode so much. It was so, so satisfying. And this is one of those ones, like the Patton one, that, and like the Brian Regan one, it's just one of those ones I will listen to, like, years from now. It's in my own kind of photo album in my heart, where I'll listen back to it and go, remember that time I had that lovely conversation with Maria Bamford? Mwah! She's a genius. Speak to you soon.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.